Hi, my name is Michael Creamer, and welcome to the We Make It Work Corporate Real Estate Podcast. This is the first podcast in a British Council of Offices trifecta and features the leaders of two of the four work streams, technology and the economy, that will be debated at the upcoming BCO conference in Dublin. And these topics are certainly of relevance to those interested in the built environment anywhere in the world. So today I'll be talking to Nigel Miller, Managing Director of Cordless Consultants, and Nick Axford, Chief Economist at Avison Young. And they are the respective leaders of those two work streams. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nick, let's start with you. One of the areas you're focused on is what you call the new economic geography of the UK. Can you describe what the key components of that is?
Yes, I think we're going to see an evolution and a continued change in the UK's economic structure. That's partly driven by the changing nature of the global economy. We're seeing deglobalization. We're seeing a change in the relationship of the UK with Europe and with the rest of the world following Brexit. And we're also seeing the emergence of a new series of industries that are going to drive forward the growth of the economy of the UK, whether that's related to data technology, whether it's related to the environment and ESG, or emerging sectors like life sciences or medical. And those sectors are going to grow and they're going to expand, and coupled with the changes that we're also seeing in the locational preferences of people and where they want to work, there are likely to be different parts of the country, whether that's at a macro level or different parts of the UK, towns, cities, urban versus suburban, compared to what we've seen before. So we'll see, alongside a reshaping of the economy, we'll see a reshaping of the geography of that economic activity.
And let's dig a little bit into cities, because obviously pre-pandemic, we would continue to see the growth of cities. And then in a way, maybe that's been paused. So is the research showing, you think, in this post-pandemic world that cities will continue to grow, or do we have this issue because of commute and time and cost maybe slowing that down or reversing it in some way?
Well, I think the answer is probably a bit of both. What we're going to see is cities changing for those people who want to get together, for those people who want to collaborate. They're going to want to come together in places that are accessible, that are amenity rich, that are lively, that are good places to be and convenient places to get to. And therefore, vibrant city centres that offer all of those things, coupled with a great quality working environment that's attractive to people, we think that that's absolutely going to thrive. But at the same time, particularly post-pandemic, we are seeing a change in the way in which people want to work. And for at least part of the week, they're also likely to be either wanting to work from home or potentially work remotely or go to other types of environments that are more convenient and easy to get to when they need an environment that isn't at home, but doesn't necessarily have all of their colleagues and facilities around them within the company.
Okay, Nigel, if we switch to you and just think a bit about the technology. Now, obviously, we're all used now to working remotely and what technology has done to enable that. But at a sort of macro level, how is technology allowing some of those changes that Nick's talking about to happen? And where do you see that going? Are we on an upward trend that's irreversible?
I think you're quite right. We saw an almost overnight switch of people that were in the past dependent on a white glove service in the office to get the video conference room ready or whatever it happened to be, suddenly becoming experts in their own right with their laptops. The interesting thing was that the technology was there and it very quickly switched in. So we saw the likes of Zoom, of course, and Teams and others suddenly be usable from the home environment. What lagged was what was in the office, in the workplace. And it was quite interesting, actually, when people started to come back, how the technology just wasn't up to it. People wanted to use what they got used to and become quite expert in, and suddenly they couldn't connect to the systems within the room and had to go back to the old stuff. So this meant there was a very quick re-engineering going on to make those places more efficient and able to connect up and easy to use, But of course, that's still going on. They're still not completely there. So there's a lot of this sort of, I guess the term hybrid's got to be brought in here, but this hybrid re-engineering of meeting spaces, probably less boardroom style and more small spaces, but that are technology rich and very able and adaptable to the technology that a person might carry, and to be able to enhance on that. So I think that's been one of the fundamental shifts. And until people feel confident that the facilities are there to easily enable that, they're going to be reluctant to come out of their broom cup.
And I guess I want to come back to that, but maybe just switch back to Nick for a second, because you mentioned vibrant cities. And if we zoom out and think about clustering, and obviously in the last few years, we've seen more and more companies thinking about where they locate near to universities, near like-minded businesses. So we see, I don't know, GSK announcing they're moving into London, MSD moving into King's Cross Quarter, both with R&D and with offices. So this idea of clustering, is that, are you seeing that, and I want to come back to the technology envelope for that, but are we seeing that, Nick, in a sort of, in the economic sense of as a driver?
Yes, I think so. And I think it comes back to the right kind of environment, and facilitating the right kind of interactions between people in the way that they want to work. And you know, there's always a trade-off between the time and effort it takes to get people together physically and the benefit that you get from doing so. So if we were each in different cities around the world recording this, we wouldn't have flown together, you know, in order to simply do it in a room, because the marginal benefit isn't there. At the same time, because we're all in London, when we were talking about recording this, we absolutely agreed that it would be a richer conversation and we would prefer to do it face to face. And so I think that, you know, the concept of clustering, the concept of having the right people together at the right time, because people, we are human animals, we do tend to respond very well to each other when we're face to face. For those that type of work, where it's creative, where, you know, you're talking about, you know, wanting unplanned collaboration, unplanned collisions, you know, all of that is still very much there. A lot of the drivers fundamentally around having people together, access to services, access to each other, and the ability to collaborate, a lot of those, you know, they haven't been destroyed by the pandemic, but the technology and the flexibility that we now have means that we don't have to be together in order to communicate. We'll want to do so when it makes sense.
Okay, and from a technology point of view, if we just stay at that kind of macro level, is there in the world of technology things that are going on that are helping those clusters? And then we can dive down into the building level as well. But I'm just wondering at that level, is there, you know?
Yeah, I think the fundamental infrastructure was there for a lot of organizations anyway. Some had a bit of a wake-up call when they had to start working from home and so on. But I think the technology is there to support those clusters, but I think the technology is evolving. So within a given area, companies can easily, you know, people can get together cross-company, cross-organization, but they can also do so to some degree from the home as well. So there's a lot more crossover of video conferencing, to give it its old term. I think what we'll see more of going forward, but the jury's out on this one at the moment, is the whole meta piece, where actually the experience of being on a video conference goes a stage further and you're placed in a 3D environment with better sound and so on. Now, I'm not sure we'll all be living in a world wearing helmets and 3D eyepieces and so on, and I'm not sure a lot of people will take to that too naturally, but I think that's how it could evolve to a degree, and we're seeing that being certainly explored by a lot of organizations. But again, back to the cluster thing, I think people coming together in the room will still always be the ultimate, and because you can read the whole person. There's so many signals that we give off as human beings that are lost in any kind of technology treatment.
In many ways, it's often positioned that, you know, the technology is enabling a replacement of face-to-face contact. Actually, in many ways, I think what's happening is that it's enhancing what used to be a call on a mobile or those awful group conference calls, everybody sitting on the phone and no one able to see each other. And clearly at the margin, we'll now do a Teams call or a video conference rather than get together where it's just convenient and quick and easy to do so. But actually, it's enhancing our ability to communicate around the times when we can be together rather than necessarily replacing the opportunity to be together when that arises.
And I think, and I want to just again keep it a macro level for a second, but if we look at, so if you think about the UK, Nick, is the data beginning to show that regional towns and smaller cities are benefiting from all this technology that allows this to happen? And are they beginning to grow at the expense of London, or is it too early to say?
I think it's too early to say, Michael. I think, but the logical consequence of all of this is that, you know, to some degree, geography is becoming less important. You know, there are people who, you know, during the pandemic took the opportunity to relocate to their holiday home, which has now become their permanent home in, you know, the Shetlands or wherever they, or Ireland, wherever they happen to want to be. And they've been able to do that almost seamlessly. And if you extend that logic, yes, absolutely. You know, many of our regional cities have great culture, great character, they're vibrant. It's just the sort of the magnetic pull of London in order to be, you know, face-to-face, to be there, because you had to be there in order to be working, and therefore, you know, there was just this automatic magnetic pull. But actually, as people start to think about rebalancing their commute, think about making lifestyle choices, then yes, I think one of the very positive things that could come out of this is that actually it becomes much easier for, you know, particularly the major regional cities to grow and to thrive, and for people to recognise that, you know, there are strong business centres in the UK outside London. And, you know, yes, you'll come to London if and when you need to, but actually, hopefully, this will actually support some of the, to get political, the levelling up of the UK's economy. And that's what we mean about the changing economic geography.
Right. And has any research been done into the time? I mean, everyone talks about the time and the cost, which I get, and I certainly know if I talk to colleagues in Europe, those who have a, let's call it a short commute, typically in a car with a car parking space under the building, are going into the office. So our offices where that is possible are probably fuller than the ones, if you take London as an example, where there's obviously a longer commute time and an increased cost. So is there any research being done that looks at what the ideal sort of time, shortness of commute time is to help people think they should come back into the office?
I don't think there's any one answer. A lot of it is about how people felt about their commute before. You know, sort of 30 to 45 minutes is generally seen as a sort of threshold. If you're traveling for more than that, you think about it more. I think, again, one of the things that's quite interesting is that people are probably more conscious of the cost of commuting now, not least because, you know, particularly in and around London, a lot of people came in every day. So you bought an annual or a monthly ticket with the parking at the station included, and you kind of didn't think about it. Then suddenly, when you're working in a more varied pattern, you know, you turn up at the station and you're asked to hand over £30 in order to come into the office. You know, that suddenly makes it much more real.
There's a toll.
You're actually spending much less, but the psychology of it is that you're almost, when you get up in the morning, thinking, okay, is it worth me spending that £30 in order to get into the office or not? So it's interesting.
Now, let's change tack a little bit and think about technology. But the other major strand that goes through everything that is going on in the built environment today is obviously environment, so ESG. Can you talk a little bit about how technology is playing its part to drive everyone's ESG agenda?
Well, I think technology certainly got a part to play on that, particularly around operational functions. So bringing efficiencies by using the technology, and it's a lot of it's sensor driven. A lot of it has to be thought about, installed at base build. There are retrofits, but that's a bit more difficult, potentially expensive and so on. But for new buildings, I think we've seen a massive switch, not from all, but from some of the developers and landlords that are now looking and saying we don't necessarily want to open the shiniest marble and glass building that's as dumb as dishwater. We need to have a bit more than that. And I think for attracting tenants and attracting people for the occupier back into the workplace, it's got to hold up as a safe, efficient, and you know, productive environment. It's got to be worth that journey that we were just talking about. And the ESG part of that is having the ability to measure and therefore monitor and therefore control and take decisions as on the building and how it's being used, potentially putting certain areas, if it's quiet, into standby. So good old Monday and Friday, you might only use half the floor plate, and when it's particularly busy midweek, getting real efficiencies from the asset. So technology's got a big role to play in that. There's the risk of overcomplicating it, and I think because those decisions have got to be made early, throwing everything at it could be, you know, not the greatest spend. So it needs analysing at an early stage. What does the developer stroke landlord hope to get and want to be able to get from that to offer up? And what are the occupiers, when they're moving into a fit out, looking for? And if those things aren't done at the right stage, then they might be precluded or cost prohibitive. So that early stage engagement, which brings me to my favourite point, strangely enough, and that is REBA stage zero. Always something to do with the architects, maybe the mechanical, electrical, you know, every service, and technology being somewhere way downstream, you know, a sort of secondary design. And it just can't be that way anymore. It's got to reach back into the base build, whatever, whether it's fit out or base build, technology's got to be an early stage consideration, because if you're going to want to use this stuff to help, whether it's in sustainability, whether it's in the magnetic effect or attraction of the building and the workplace, technology's got a big role to play, but you can't necessarily bolt it on when you're in the final design stages.
Right, and so to be clear, and I think I'm repeating what you said, is that, I guess, historically, let's say, the technology backbone of the building wasn't thought about at RIBA stage one.
Yep.
And by the time you come in, there's only either a certain amount you can and can't do, or the cost is cost prohibitive from doing it the way you'd otherwise do it.
Yeah.
And I think the second sort of point about that is that it's all about data capture, is that right? Because once you've got the technology needs to capture the data, and then the technology needs to be able to analyze the data,
yep,
to give you something that tells you how well run your building is from an environmental point of view.
Absolutely. And I think at this early stage, because it is still a morphing situation, we've seen a lot of people throw the technology in without really thinking about what they want to get out of it. So they're drowning in data. Now is, how do you start to decipher that? How do you slice and dice that data and get real meaningful outcomes from it? So you almost got to switch that on its head and say, what do you want to get out of this? What are the meaningful things that you as an organisation, whether it's landlord, whether it's occupier, what are the things you need to get out of that? And then start to apply the technology. There might be things that are day two, but it's worth considering those as well. But just to put everything in, you could end up drowning in data, but not actually getting any meaningful output from it. So, yeah, it's a big swing. Data analytics will be a very important part of the whole workplace. But to get those analytics, you need the technology in place.
And are you, I guess there's a lot of questions for me that come out of that. But one is, that's about not only understanding government legislation, which is obviously increasing, it's also about understanding what the occupier either wants or is, frankly, stated in reports that they're going to be doing. So they need to have that data to be able to report, because we're finding a lot of occupiers are doing much more than the regulation. It's kind of like one goes ahead of the other, then one goes ahead of the other. So in a really good way, their government regulation and businesses are pushing each other further and further. Does that make deciding what technology you put in the building to collect what data more challenging, I guess?
Well, in some ways it can set a bit of a framework, can't it, as a minimum level. So I think in some ways it makes it that bit easier, because you've got to go to a certain point. It's beyond that and how clever you're going to get with it. So I think there's one aspect which is supporting the sustainability, the efficiency of the building, which you can do with intelligent systems and BMS systems that have evolved from the old flashing red light in a box in the corner somewhere. They're a lot more intelligent now, and you see a lot less design clashes. I mean, most buildings were commissioned, as I'm sure a lot of people are aware, but with those design clashes, they're never fully commissioned. You know, it's just like get the thing on stream, and it never got revisited. So there would be, for example, heating and cooling in a similar area fighting each other, and more intelligent systems, and increasingly so, will be able to sense that and self-correct. So I think from that aspect, that helps the ESG piece, the sustainability piece. It also is almost a sort of baseline. Right. And when you start to get into more clever stuff, I think it becomes, and a lot of reports and things that I've looked at recently are starting to state that the magnetic effect of the office, and by that I mean the attraction, is one of the big important pieces. Safety is almost there, because that's an important part, of course. So safety is almost there as a given, along with sustainability, but the attraction, the magnetic aspect of the office to pull people back in and make them want to come in that much more is quite a way up there now. It's coming into focus a great deal. So how technology can help and be better than you've got at home, because in the pandemic, people have better technology at home than in the workplace, if they could have got there, of course. But it's a very interesting, evolving situation.
And Nick, back to you. If we take that to, let's just talk about London for a little bit, because obviously London acts as the, I guess, the gravitational pull, the magnet for a lot of UK's business. Just thinking about it in terms of the built environment and some of what Nigel's been saying in terms of the stock of buildings, how does London sort of compare globally as a city? I mean, are we doing lots of really good things that mean that it's going to maintain its, you know, preeminence, let's say, in financial markets and elsewhere?
That's a huge question. You know, we need to provide the right environment to be the home for the businesses that want to be here. But I'm not sure that, you know, London can compete on the basis that it's just got great buildings, because everywhere's got great buildings. And so there are much bigger picture political and economic drivers going on. There is a really genuine question about, you know, can London be the financial capital of Europe when we're not in Europe? And from a regulatory point of view, there are all sorts of questions around, you know, how is London going to interact with the financial and capital markets around the world, but particularly those in Europe, when, you know, we are effectively going to be at the whim of what, you know, the European Union decides to do from a regulatory point of view. And, you know, like it or not, a huge part of London's role as a business centre has been founded on, you know, its importance as a financial and capital markets centre, because off that comes all of the other professional and business and advisory services and the things that then feed off that. And that agglomeration back to that clustering point then makes the city work extremely effectively. But there's no question that London has to be able to compete on all sorts of levels as a place that people want to be. They want to be to do business, and they want to be in order to live. And London is a great city, but, you know, if we haven't got the right transport infrastructure, if we haven't got the right data and technology infrastructure, if we haven't got the right regulatory frameworks, then just as, you know, people who live in the suburbs are going to decide they don't want to commute in, people around the world, businesses around the world, are not going to look at London as being the right place to be. And there's no question that, you know, London faces some challenges on many of those fronts at the moment. And it's really important, not just for London, but really important for the UK, that those challenges are tackled. And that means, you know, an effective collaboration between business and government to understand what's needed in order to position the UK in the European and global economies, and make sure that all the different bits, whether that's the national regulatory framework down to, you know, the way in which city is, you know, London is run and governed and managed as a city, you know, all of those things need to be right. Otherwise, London's position in the world will suffer, and that will hit the UK. We have no God-given right for London to be a world city. It has to earn that position.
Okay, and as we maybe just think about wrapping this up, I mean, we've touched on some of the points that you've both been researching as part of this BCO initiative. Nigel, maybe coming to you, are there any other areas that you'd like to kind of cover off or touch on that you and your team are looking at as part of this technology focus, let's call it?
Well, I think the two main things we have touched on, one is how audiovisual technology, you know, everything that enables us to communicate well is evolving. And there is a lot of it re-engineering and a hell of a lot of new technology coming through. You know, it's moving faster than I've ever seen it in a lifetime in technology. So AI will have an even bigger role to play there. So that's one big part, which is an enabler, I guess, but it's also an attraction, because if people have got those facilities, they're more likely to come in. The other is the smart building, the intelligent building, which, you know, is almost starting to sound a bit of a hackneyed phrase now, in that it's a bit overused, certainly the smart building, but we're only now starting to see, you know, the real use of that coming on stream. But it is something that a lot of particularly developers now are starting to turn their mind to, because, as I said right at the beginning, opening, you know, the dumbest building in London isn't really going to attract a lot of people back. So the focus on that and how well that is used, how well the data is collected, analysed, and fed back in on a recycling is the forward position, you know, sort of Reba 7. So earlier on I was saying, you know, seeing technology in Reba 0, right at the beginning, when you're looking, what is the answer, what are you trying to get out of this, is as important. But then when you get to Reba 7, once the building's commissioned, it's being used, all these great sensors are doing their thing, probably need a year for things to settle out before you can actually start getting some meaningful data from that and refeeding that into the system to make those intelligent tweaks and changes that just continually improve, whether that's in an efficiency, whether it's in the attraction of the building and the other facilities that are there. So I think we're seeing this sort of disparity, very early stage, and a continued life cycle that goes on beyond occupation of the building by years.
Interesting. As you say, all of those things have a financial impact on the developer owner, obviously, and therefore one wonders how that passes through in terms of rental levels and how much space people take. And so there's a lot of really interesting consequences, which I guess time will show us what that means. And Nick, maybe same question to you in terms of the research part of your BCO initiative. Are there other things that we need to touch on to wrap up?
Yes, I think the most important thing is the wider role that offices and workplaces play in place and in community. And, you know, what we've seen ushered in by the pandemic is offices facing its e-commerce moment. You know, retail's been going through this for 10 or 15 years now. As people get a choice of whether to shop in person or shop online, then, you know, that's caused huge disruption. And that's exactly the moment that we're at now from an office point of view. But if we think back to that retail example, I think we're all well aware of, you know, the incredible damage that's been done to many of our, you know, not necessarily the big cities in the UK, but towns and communities that have been hugely impacted by the hollowing out of local retail, which really sat at the heart of those towns and communities. And, you know, we're at risk of the same thing now happening from an office point of view. If we're not able to revitalize those towns and town centres, if we see the same hollowing out of office-type employment out of them that we've seen with retail, I think that poses real threats to the structure of many of those towns and cities. But at the same time, as we were talking about, I think it offers a huge opportunity. We have local authorities and governments that are now very focused on this issue. We have, you know, a development and particularly an investment community that now genuinely recognises the importance of the S in ESG, social value, and the opportunity for the public and private sectors to work together, investment capital to come in with long-term vision-driven projects to genuinely revitalise, you know, town centres and smaller cities in order to provide the kind of living, leisure, working and shopping environments that are going to be different from what was needed in the past. But this really is a time where I think, you know, the BCO membership and the community, particularly on the supply side, needs to really recognise that there is an opportunity there, but there's also a responsibility. These offices are not just investment assets. They are, you know, the very heart of part of our communities, and we really need to take that responsibility very seriously.
To cut in on that, Nick, I think your parallel with the retail sector is a good one. At the time, we called it bricks and clicks, and there was this whole thing of, you know, how's it going to change? And we've seen a lot of that now, as we well know. But the real success, and even back when God was a boy, really, it seems now, it's a long time ago, we were looking at how organisations would win in that situation. And the ones that really grasped it seemed to grasp their online as well as their physical, and they weren't necessarily commodity products because you can just order those and get them delivered. It was things that need an experience. So I guess, of course, a great example of that would be Apple and the Apple showrooms. You can't buy the product there, but you can go in, you can get service, you can touch it, you can, you know, learn about it, and then you order it online. And I think the workplace and the office sector is going to have a similar thing. If you just have the standard commodity product, people aren't going to go to it. If it brings something refreshing, new, and way beyond what you can do from home, then people are going to use it some of the time, not all of the time.
So omni-channel office work, or omni-channel environments, and people having that choice, and as you say, making the office an experience. And I think it's a really good place to wrap up, but this idea that the social aspect of what owners and developers need to be thinking about, and how what they do binds a community together to some extent, or the opposite, is crucial. So a lot of really interesting themes in that from that, and on the technology side, and how we're going to be able to hopefully collect more data and use it. So Nick and Nigel, thank you so much for joining, and enjoy the conference when it comes.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.